The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be speaking to Tom Vanderbilt, science writer and author of a new book called Beginners, in which he tries several new things to understand the joys of learning and how it affects our brain. If you're someone who's interested in communicating science, or that's part of your job, you can hear Tom speak at SciComm, the conference that I run. It's happening the 9th and 10th of March virtually at scicom.ie, S-C-I-C-O-M.ie. All right. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of your comments at the end of the podcast talking about last week's show. Now, it's time to look back at the week's science news with Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Duncan. You're both very welcome. Our first story. It's a life on Mars. Shane, has to be, of course, the Perseverance landing, which I watched with my kids on Thursday night. Absolutely fantastic achievement. Tell us all about it.
Yes, late on Thursday evening, Irish time, the NASA Perseverance Martian rover ended its seven-month journey and spectacularly touched down on the surface of Mars within a huge accuracy. It was incredible what happened. So this thing took 7 months. It's traveled an incredible 472 million kilometers. And we talked about it on this program when it took off. And it arrived to Mars and it kind of first delved into the atmosphere at an incredible 19,000 kilometers an hour. So pretty fast. So then began the 7 minutes of terror. That's NASA's word. I assume it's a technical term for landing. And they used a heat shield, firstly, to slow the rover down to a tenth of its initial velocity. Then they deployed a parachute to slow it further. And finally, they cut the strings of the parachute and they engaged thrusters, and the craft hovered 20 meters above the surface, and it deployed these cables that landed down to the surface in a structure called a sky crane, and that facilitated the very smooth landing of the Perseverance rover. So a huge feat of engineering to get this thing to land safely. And next comes the science. So after all that engineering, now we get to do something with it. Would want to. The thing costs $2.7 billion. So we want to, So what are they looking for? They're looking for fossilized signs of microbes that they suspect are around 3 billion years old when Mars was warmer, wetter, and thus more hospitable for life. And this is the first of a series of missions to collect, to analyze, and crucially return samples to Earth such that we can understand whether life once held on Mars or not.
Yeah, it takes soil samples, and it doesn't analyze them to the level we need them analyzed. It sort of poops them out in these tubes, and then those tubes are left there to be collected in another 10 years. It's such an extraordinary way to do things, but obviously each of these missions is planned within an inch of its life. I mean, many of these engineers have given over 10 years just for this one project to get this one lander here. So what, it seems crazy that we scoop up soil and then we just drop them in tubes on the ground for another mission to pick up in 10 years' time. This is the best way to do it. Don't ask me why I missed that part. I fell asleep. Our second story, Lara, has to do with the remarkable COVID infection trial and 90 volunteers in the United Kingdom taking part in it. What exactly is happening?
Yeah, absolutely, Jonathan. It's not as interesting as pooping out space dust, but there is now ethical approval for the first human challenge study of coronavirus to go ahead in the UK. A human challenge study is very much what it sounds like. It is, you take healthy humans and you give them a disease. It's been done in the past for certain diseases like cholera and influenza. And it has now been approved in the UK. So they are going to recruit 90 healthy adult volunteers aged 18 to 30. And they are going to have them essentially quarantine, move into this hospital in London called the Royal Free Hospital. When they've been there for 2 days and they've passed all the health check they need to pass, they will get drops of the virus put into their noses, and then they will be monitored for a minimum of 14 days after that with daily blood samples, daily nasal swabs. And they're also going to assess their sense of smell, do cognitive tests, all of these things. And then if they are well after the 14 days, presumably they will then be released and they will be followed up for a full year and paid reasonably handsomely, about £4,500 for the luxury of taking part in this study. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's run by the Imperial College London by Professor Peter Openshaw. I have serious reservations, to be honest, about this. Their idea at the moment is to try and see what the minimum amount of coronavirus needed to cause an infection in humans but not cause symptoms. And I do understand the need for human challenge studies in certain circumstances where you're testing a vaccine or you're desperately looking for better treatment. I have massive ethical issues with this, and I don't think potentially that it's necessary. I know it's not necessarily my job to say that, but I've seen a lot of people suffer from coronavirus here in the hospital, and I've watched people very sadly die, and young people as well. And I do think that it's really important to get better vaccines and better treatments, but we have good vaccines and we have good treatments. And I just don't know, this doesn't sit quite right with me, but maybe you guys disagree.
Well, look, I mean, the truth of the matter is we have a virus that is threatening the lives of tens of millions of people. And if you take, I suppose, the analogy of war, if there is a common larger goal, what are you willing to risk to get it? And I suppose that's the big question. I don't think I would put myself up for this necessarily. My issue is the age profile and the financial remuneration, because young people getting access to that sort of money, it would make it very attractive to them. And I, to be honest, you could have told me what risks were involved at 18.
Yep.
Look, yeah. I'm only talking personally. I know there are lots of very smart. I was a bit naive, a bit childish.
There's a lot of naive ones too, Johnny. And it's a risk benefit analysis. And I absolutely understand. I mean, the concept of war is the same idea. If there is an important benefit that you think you can gain, I don't see it here. But maybe that's just me. I'm sure lots of people would disagree, but I'm not sure I'm on board.
I think this demonstrates the need to have proper resourced ethicists. You know, people who
I'm sure
are...
this was now out there, Shane.
It has passed ethical approval. I'm not questioning them. I'm just not sure.
But I accept these things pass approval, otherwise they wouldn't happen. But I don't know whether, like, to your point, Lara, I don't know whether this is ethically the right thing to do in general, you know?
Do you know what? This probably is more failure of communication in that we're all kind of going, I don't know about that. I mean, obviously, smart, educated people have really thought this through. I think perhaps a communications issue could be at fault here.
You could be right. Yeah. I mean, I keep screaming do no harm in my head. But yeah, you know what? Maybe we're missing something.
Well, look, let's hope that these 90 volunteers get through it with as little discomfort as possible. Shane, a really interesting story about Neanderthals and claims of a new study that possibly their decline was due to the flip of a magnetic field.
Yeah, that's right. And when I read it first, I read the decline of the Netherlands, which tells me that my week has been a long week. But yes, this is about a flip of the Earth's magnetic poles. So we know that the Earth has an iron core, and that gives rise to a huge magnetic field within it. And this is really important. This magnetic field is part of the reason that we have life on Earth, because it provides an invisible shield around us to keep cosmic radiation away. It deflects it. And so it causes us to kind of live in a safe bubble. And so every so often that flips and it changes. So north becomes south, and it takes maybe 1,000 years for the flip to happen. One such flip happened 42,000 years ago, and it coincided with a drop in solar activity. And scientists in New South Wales have published this week in the journal Science that they reckon that this combination of events may have led to a significant change in the climate of the Earth, and that had consequences they model for primitive human species that lived here. And so what did they do to make this measurement? They looked at carbon-14, which is an isotope of carbon. There would have been elevated levels of it in the atmosphere due to the absence of the magnetic shield. And they're able to show that at that precise moment in geological history, there was a huge change. A lot of megafauna died out, similar to like a lot of the other mass extinction events that we're familiar with. And they're saying that would have had huge effect on things like Neanderthals getting kind of a grip and forming big societies as they would have done at that time.
Wow. It's an interesting theory. 40,000 years ago, you say?
42,000 years ago.
So what about humans, though? Humans were thriving at that time.
We were around. I guess it's just where we were and what we were eating and how we were surviving. So perhaps Homo sapien was doing something slightly different, and it had a slight advantage that was it was able to weather it. Like the Ice Age hadn't happened yet. So that was another big thing for us to get through. What I think is rather worrying, though, just to really kind of pile on with 2021, the ominous warning at the end of this paper says that the field, the magnetic fields of the Earth has weakened by 9% over the last 170 years. And they say another flip is on the cards. And the first signs we would see of that would be basically that we'd lose our capacity to transmit electricity through high tension cables, and we wouldn't have any satellite systems. So yeah, that's really going to add to lockdown.
Oh my God. All right. Finally, Lara, our final story is about a study that has remarkable results for those battling their weight.
Definitely. And thankfully, it's a good news story after Shane's horrible story.
Well,
now.
Look, you know, it's like when will an asteroid hit? I think it's so unpredictably far in the future.
He still sufficiently freaked me out. But this is a good news story. So this is a wonderful study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine. There's a drug that's used currently called semaglutide, and it's used for people who have type 2 diabetes. So that's generally adult onset diabetes. And it's used at a certain dosage. It's 1 milligram once a week. It's a little injection under the skin. But what these researchers did is they took nearly 2,000 adults who had an average weight of 105 kilos. So that's 16.5 stone for every Irish person who isn't a doctor, because nobody thinks in kilos except for us. But they took these people, nearly 2,000 of them, across 16 different countries. And they increased the dose. They gave them 2.4 milligrams. And they looked at these people taking it once a week, every week, for 68 weeks. So a little bit over a year. And what they saw was remarkable. So not only did their waist circumference decrease, the fats in their blood decreased, the sugar in their blood pressure, everything that is negative basically has decreased. But they lost so much weight. The average weight loss was a whopping nearly 3 stones, so just over 15 kilos. In the control group, it wasn't even half a stone, about 2 kilos or just over 2 kilos. And they found that 75% of people lost more than 10% of their body weight. And the reason that is fascinating is because anyone who's worked in obesity will tell you that the very sad fact is that pretty much no more than 10% of people could ever lose more than 10% of their body weight. It's sad and it's really striking. But generally, when you move down the path towards overweight and obesity, it's very hard to come back. But 3/4 of these people lost more than 10% of their body weight, and more than a third lost over 20% of their body weight. It's an absolute game changer. And one of the things I've also learned about COVID in the hospitals is that people with obesity really, really suffer and often die as a result because of the COVID. And so not only for COVID infections, but for everything. This is just phenomenal research with very few side effects as well, which is really wonderful.
I mean, that is a presumably some pharmaceutical goldmine if it gets to. What sort of trials are we talking about here? Is this a large scale phase 3?
Absolutely. It's a phase 3. Yeah, they had 1,961 adults spread over 16 different countries, 129 centres. It's very big, and it's a very safe drug. It's used. I mean, we prescribe it in the hospital every day to people. Well, not every day, but it's a very commonly used drug at a lower dose anyway. So it's already well researched. It's just phenomenal. It's a game changer, as the headline said. But like Shane, I also read it as a German drug, Gamma Changer. So none of us have had a very good week. But this is a game changer.
Dr. Lara Dungan, Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much. Yes, you're welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. Now, none of my close friends know this, actually, but over the past year, I've been learning piano. I came across this app by a company called JoyTunes, and they have an app that listens to the piano and tells you if you've gotten the note correctly, so you can teach yourself. And it's amazing. And so now I can play some light chord styling. I can do A minor, G, D, C, F, and some other slight melody work. And it's been really liberating as an adult, because I've always wanted to do this and I never had the time. And of course, we all have a little bit more time on our hands over the last while. And this idea of starting something new is of course, being proliferated across the internet, people baking sourdough and doing all sorts of new things. So it's actually perfect timing. The Tom Vanderbilt book came out, Beginners, which is all about learning new things and the joy of learning things as an adult. He learned lots of things in his book. He joins us now. Tom, what gave you the idea to explore this idea of learning and beginning new things?
Thanks, Jonathan. Great to be here. And, you know, I think it was essentially being a parent, which thrusts one suddenly into the role of being a teacher, which hopefully that you're teaching things that you actually know how to do. But sometimes you run across things that you actually don't know how to do. And one of these things was actually the game of chess. One day my daughter was about 4 years old. She asked, she saw a chessboard and said, "Can we play that game? It looks really cool." And I said, you know, I would love to. I actually never really learned. And this is sort of an embarrassing thing to have to admit. But chess, you know, the basic rules are not so complicated. I set out to learn myself using a variety of apps, sort of the way you describe. But I found that, you know, the complexity of the game was quickly, I felt I was in over my head. And I thought, well, I've absorbed a lot of the sort of current of thought that's out there that chess is good for children, that it makes them smart. So I sort of was drinking the Kool-Aid in that regard. So I thought, well, if I want her to try this game and to actually get good at this game, she's probably going to need someone with a little bit more firepower than me. So I hired a coach. Coach
you
came over.
You hired a chess coach for a four-year-old?
Yes, I know this sounds the worst, you know, sort of a, you know, helicopter tiger parenting possible, but it's not an uncommon thing in the world of New York City scholastic chess. But, you know, again, this was not meant for a competitive, you know, we didn't know where it was going. I just thought, well, let's.
Yes, you
let's,
did.
Let's
you were thinking my child's going to be a genius. Let's foster that, as all parents do, as I do.
And of course, there's some famous history with overactive chess parents, you know, essentially breeding future grandmasters, but we won't get into that. But I did not think I was going to be the next Laszlo Polgar. But so, you know, but the coach was coming over. I thought, well, why am I now paying this person to teach my daughter when there's this game sitting in front of me that I would really like to get better at myself? And so I joined the game and was so struck by this experience. It led me to think that, you know, as I was taking my young daughter to a variety of these things that she wanted to learn, swimming, she had a go at indoor rock climbing. You know, I was often just sitting on the sidelines, waiting, often looking at my phone, doing essentially nothing productive. So I thought, you know, what was the last thing I'd actually learned? Here I am preaching to her the importance of learning a wide range of things, whether or not she's going to be good at them or not, but just this exploratory joy. And when the mirror was turned on myself, I was sort of sitting in this rut of things I really, of having not learned anything substantially new in terms of skills in quite a long time. So that was sort of the genesis for the book in a long-winded way.
So I want to talk about the benefits to the brain of learning and also unlearning, which is an interesting concept. But before I do, just take us through some of the different skills that you tried over the last while to see if you could at least become proficient in.
Sure. I had a short list of things that were, I was genuinely had a desire to learn. I think this is an important part because motivation is such a key part of learning. If you take up something that you're not actually that interested in, it's you're sort of behind from the get-go. So I did surfing, singing, drawing, a making component, which ended up being a wedding ring because I lost two of my original wedding rings while trying to learn to surf. And then the last thing was juggling, which sort of has a long history in the world of psychology and the study of motor skills. So I thought that was a nice way to sort of also look at the learning aspect, as well as just being a fun thing that, for example, turns you into an instant hero at kids' birthday parties when you can, you know, break out a little juggling.
Yeah, for sure. So when we throw ourselves into something, is it different for a child's brain than it is for an adult's brain? This old adage of you can't teach an old dog new tricks, is that borne out in neuroscience?
There's definitely some truth to that. I mean, children and adults are sort of coming from two different ends of the spectrum. Children have these very unoccupied brains, if you will, filled with many synapses that have yet to be pruned. They're sort of making sense of the world around them, absorbing new information. Whereas adults, you know, I use the metaphor of that sort of teeming old hard drive of an older PC you might have that's filled with files that you go to open up a new file and it's whirring around and clicking and searching for this thing. So for us to go learn a new motor skill, for example, we have this memory of all of the other motor skills literally sort of living in our brain and our muscles. So for me to learn a new language, for example, I'm so well tuned to the sound of English and the grammar of English that history is going to cause interference, is the word that scientists use. A child has less memory of that grammar, that's why, and the scientists talk about these sensitive periods where children are, you know, sort of this magic window where you can learn a skill much more effectively. This is not to say that adults cannot do it, and there are some advantages we have in terms of what's called crystallized intelligence, you know, having wisdom, having patience, knowing what's important in a learning process. But there's sort of a general, you know, philosophical divide going on here that it's called explore versus exploit. Alison Gopnik, the psychologist, uses that phrase. You know, children are in exploratory mode. They are, you know, trying to gather as much information as possible, willing to make, you know, inferences about things. Adults tend to go with an exploit mode. We tend to take advantage of what we already know. So in a sense, you know, we're a bit more sort of jaded, if you will, and it can be harder for us to see new solutions that might be in front of us, where a child has this, what the Buddhists call beginner's mind, which is sort of more open and more, flexible. But the good news is adults can learn. You may just have to work harder, and the brain is going to have to come up with some sort of fancy jury rigging to make some of those processes work. The brain sort of draws on a wider range of areas for an adult than a child, which, you know, essentially means it's working harder.
Did you come across any interesting research on how we learn and sort of tips or hacks on how to learn better? I'm always trying to take in new information, and sometimes it just sieves through my brain, and other times I feel like I'm immersed in it and it works. Did you look at sort of engagement and learning research in that way?
I did, and there's a fair amount of it out there, because this is something that naturally people have an interest in. I mean, no one wants to learn particularly slowly, let's say. But so some of the obvious things, and I sort of took advantage of some of these resources as well. I mean, one of the big findings is the idea of spaced repetition, you know, sort of learning things over time, coming back to them, walking away from them, rather than trying to cram for an exam, for example, the night before. So in a game of chess, for example, there's an app called Chessable, which uses a lot of these techniques, where you'll sort of learn a certain opening or learn a pattern, and then you'll move on for a while, then you'll have sort of a refresher a week later. And, you know, so that was useful in a way. And there's some, you know, coaches would give me a lot of tips. For example, one of the things that often happens for any skill learning process is you quickly find out that progress often isn't linear. You're not always just going up. Sometimes you sort of go backwards and you hit these plateaus. So in the world of juggling, I would do 50 or 60 cycles, as they're called, of three balls, tossing these balls without a hitch. The next day I would be struggling to do 8 or 9, and I would suddenly think I had completely lost it. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what's going on, that the brain is sort of, you know, working on this new problem that you've absorbed. And it's often a signal to move on and give yourself the next harder challenge, and to look for that zone of what's called desirable difficulty. So the coaches will say, this is why it's important to, you know, change up your practice. This is another sort of key finding in motor skill learning. You know, don't just endlessly drill the same thing over and over again. So with juggling, you know, change the objects that you're throwing, change the room you're throwing in. If you're starting with your left hand, start with your right hand instead. You know, sing a song while you're trying. I mean, just anything, because learning is not often such a rigid process. You need to have a lot of different potential solutions in reserve to solve the problems that will come up. You know, you don't want to be sort of too rigid. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other, you know, interesting things like transcranial direct stimulation, which is the application of electric currents to your brain. This is said to have some possible benefits for learning. And there's also some pharmaceutical products that are out there. I did not sort of go into this because
I didn't do that. Well,
I mean, part of my whole thesis of my book was a little bit of a movement against some of the what I call the Silicon Valley hacking style of learning, to sort of learn something in 30 days to sort of cross it off of a bucket list, or to be so
the Blinkist approach to learning.
Yeah, well, you know, it was the slow food, the slow learning. I sort of wanted to appreciate the struggle. I mean, this is not to say I wouldn't like to wake up some days and just know how to surf like Keanu Reeves in The Matrix.
Do we learn things differently when we're learning with our body as opposed to intellectually? Chess is obviously not a physical sport, unless you're talking about chess boxing. typically, it doesn't exert a lot of physical energy, but it takes a lot of brain energy. And then surfing, obviously, is a lot about where your body is in the space. And there's a bit of psychology as well, but a lot of it is physical, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really two entirely different types of learning and areas of the brain. And it's sort of broken down in what's called declarative knowledge and procedural knowledge. Declarative knowledge is the things that we know. Procedural knowledge is the things that we know how to do. And there's the great example of how this was shown in science with the famous amnesiac patient known as HM in the United States, who had this case, you know, rather severe case of amnesia, and he was taught a sort of novel motor skills exercise in the lab. And he was taught it every day. And the following day, he would be asked if he knew how to do this, and he had no memory of having learned it the day before, yet he was actually making progress on the actual test. So it's you know, there's a whole argument that when learning motor skills, the less you can be intellectually involved, the better it is for you, because you're sort of crossing wires there and getting in the way of that learning. If we think of what's called an overlearned activity like walking, you don't want to think about walking at this point in your life. You'll just walk less effectively. Yeah. The trick is, you know, to save your brain energy, we've learned to do these things efficiently. So
the funny thing about that is, Tom, I don't know how much TV you've done, but when you have to walk on TV, it's like you physically have to think about walking again. It was weirdly one of the hardest things I had to do. I had to consciously think about walking because I had to go, you know, from one part of the shot to another, and I had to do it naturally. And so it was a weird thing as a TV presenter. I don't know if anyone else listening has found that, but I found, you know, walking a difficult thing because it suddenly became conscious of your movements. And then I found myself bumping into people as I was walking. But maybe I'm an idiot.
I mean, the extent to which we're sort of operating on autopilot in our everyday life is tremendous. And I would give listeners the example of, you know, you go to an airport and the escalator is out of order. And as you approach that escalator, the moment you step on it, you feel like you're still in motion for a brief second. And that what's going on there is the brain, you know, work by Lisa Feldman Barrett has demonstrated, you know, is a prediction machine. We're always trying to predict what's ahead of us by a few seconds. So we've already made this assumption of what an escalator feels like because we know, and then we briefly have to unlearn, if you will, what's happening, you know, with this new case, because it's an entirely new escalator. And that might last for weeks, the sort of memory of what we used to know about that escalator. So we're sort of operating on autopilot, which is actually generally a good thing until something goes wrong.
You had an interesting experience that I wanted to talk about, which was trying to learn to ride a bicycle that went the opposite direction that a bicycle normally goes. So when you turn left, it goes right. This is with Destin, who's a, what's his YouTube channel? He's a big YouTuber in the States.
Smarter every day.
Smarter every day. Yeah. So this is something that you can do without thinking, except it was wired the wrong way. Exact same motor skills, but completely anti-intuitive. How did you find that task? And did you ever manage to master it? And why is that so hard to do?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've been told by a number of people in the UK that this often shows up in places like fairs at UK, where there will be a person offering you a certain cash prize if you can ride this bicycle for even 5 feet. And of course, you know, it's a money-making enterprise for that person, because most people, you know, most normal people really cannot ride it. And, you know, even the process of riding a bike itself is a little bit of a mystery that certain physicists have been working on for a long time. And if I were to tell listeners that, you know, when you turn a bicycle to the right, in fact, you're actually counter steering to the left as you make that turn, before you make that turn, it's something that doesn't really click with people because it doesn't sound right. And again, it's this example of what we do with our bodies we might not have conscious awareness of. So the problem with the backwards bicycle is that, going back to what I said about adults versus children, I have many decades of bicycling experience. I consider myself to be a rather proficient cyclist. That led me to having a bit of an ego as I went down to Alabama, where Destin works as a rocket scientist at Redstone Arsenal. You know, I thought, well, I can ride a bike, so I can ride this bike. I thought, you know, I'll ride it no-handed. I'll cross my arms. I'll put my right hand on the left. I had all these hacks in my mind. And of course, they all failed completely because, the more knowledge you have of how to ride a traditional bicycle, the harder it's going to be to override this paradigm in your brain. And it took Destin about 6 months of, not necessarily daily, but rather frequent practice to get to the point where he could ride this. And then, of course, the problem was he went to ride a traditional bicycle in, I think, Washington, D.C., and he had a brief moment of problem with that. So there's this idea of switching between these things. And there was even an old school of, let's say, experimental psychology that people were arguing if you purposely set out to write with both hands, you could actually become smarter. And that sort of, there was never any proof of that. But so I'm not going to argue that riding both ways is going to make you a better cyclist. It may make you slightly worse at both. But I never learned. I was there a day, and the mere act of sitting on the bicycle was very disconcerting. The whole architecture was different. It threw off my innate sense of balance, and complete and utter failure.
Finally, do we get benefits from trying new things in our middle or older ages beyond being smug or being doing that? Are there benefits to the brain? Does it delay aging? Does it delay dementia? Is there any good evidence to suggest that there's good biological or psychological benefits to learning a new thing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we all would intuitively think that working any other set of muscles as we age would be a good thing to sort of at least prevent stasis and to not necessarily make massive improvements and, you know, but to at least, you know, sort of keep at a baseline. So in the same way, the brain as a muscle, there's very interesting sets of evidence from the case that I cite is at the University of Texas, the Park Laboratory. You know, one interesting example, they had some older adults learn a set of skills, and they had a control group that merely met to socialize. And they were tested before and after on a set of these cognitive battery tests that had nothing to do with the skills itself. They were just general intelligence and things like that. And the group that took the new classes, which were things like digital photography and quilting, did better after the experiment than the control group did on that cognitive battery. It's not that there's not a benefit to getting together with people and socializing. It's just there seemed to be some level of brain activity that was going on that really enhanced, you know, strengthened the muscle, and they did better in a on this test. So I think, you know, absolutely. And in terms of learning multiple things at one time, there's even some evidence out of University of California that this can a little bit more bang for your buck. I compare it to sort of high intensity interval training. You know, rather than grinding out one long marathon, sort of switching in these short bursts of activity in different fields. That's a little more speculative on my part, but to my mind, it just made life even that much more exciting and fun to be sort of, you know, continuously out of my comfort zone and switching. But I think you basically roll back the odometer in your brain by learning these things. And just one last point is that neuroplasticity, this ability of the brain to sort of reshape itself in the face of learning new skills, a study that looked at juggling found that older people, you know, essentially had just about as much as younger people, a shift in neuroplasticity in learning to juggle. So right. it never really goes away.
Tom Vanderbilt, the book is called Beginners. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Yes, Tom will be speaking at SciComm, the conference for anyone who communicates science to any audience, really. Their website is SciComm, SEICOM.ie. Full disclosure, I run that conference. so I have a vested interest in you buying a ticket. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins us on the program to go through last week's emails and texts. How's it going? Did you pick up any new skills in the past year, Aidan?
New skills? Yeah, not skills really. Like, you know, I learned a few new recipes. I undertook a writing project, but which is sort of a new skill. I've never done that before.
Write a book, right? That's
pretty impressive. I'm trying to write. Like, I've written things before, but yeah, it's the first time I've tried to write a book, so I learned a bit of drafting and things like that, I guess. Yeah, so there.
How's the whole book thing going?
It's gone very well. I think it's keeping me quite sane. I'm on my second draft now, so it's kind of exciting because the first draft, let's be honest, a lot of it is rubbish. you just want to get to the end of the story and go, right, I won't worry about any of that, and I'll go back over it. But now I'm kind of going back over it and fixing chapters, and I'm like, this might actually not be terrible, which is exciting. Mm.
But, you know, my hat off to you, because you're, you know, a talented musician, you know, had a talented career at music. Now you're writing a book, like all of these things that require a lot of effort, and like just learning the piano now, I realize how wonderful it would have been to have been forced, like I'm forcing my child to learn music as a boy, and be really good at this, because I'm really enjoying it, but it's slow, it's hard. Like I'm getting into, you know, beyond chords and into styling and stuff, and it's like your brain is like, This is partially being an adult and not being a child, but I think it's hard for kids too.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of jealous of you. I think that the piano thing is such a great instrument to learn, yeah. And I would say definitely stick with that, forcing your kids to do it, because I was forced to play clarinet, which I thought was amazingly uncool, but it kind of gave me a grounding. Like, I didn't play much clarinet in my adult life, but I knew stuff about music kind of by default.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots to have learned, and Casper is way better than me at piano by a long chalk. He's really impressive. He's 9, and he's just been following this app at the end of a pointy stick. And he's, you know, at times he's really been into it. Other times I'm like, you have to go up there and do it. And I emotionally manipulate him as well. I do everything. I you know, sometimes he just goes. Other times I say, you have to go. And other times I say, look, you'll get this. And other times I say, you know, I'll be disappointed in you if you don't become a professional pianist. Is that good psychology for children? I think it's good. What I'm hoping is he'll try and he'll fail, and that's okay. And I'll let him know that's okay. But if by failing to become a professional pianist, hopefully he'll be a really good pianist.
Or, you know, he'll succeed, be the greatest pianist in the world, but really resent you.
Ah, I'm fine with that. Hey, you know what? He resents me anyway. Right, let's have a look at the texts and tweets from last week. We were talking about Neanderthals. An ancient musical instrument was found, a conch that had been sitting gathering dust in a museum in London. They found there was ink on the inside and 3 holes, and that you could play it. And we were joking about how crap that is as a musical instrument, those 3 tones, and this is a conch. And someone says, guys will be laughed out of the conch republic of the Florida Keys. Conch is pronounced conch, not conch. No, it's not. that's the Americans mispronouncing conch, right?
I don't know.
Say niche.
Yeah,
like, it's not a niche, it's a niche.
I've always called it conch.
It's a conch. It's a conch. It's not a conk. A conk. I think that's just Americans just going, ah.
Maybe that's the Neanderthal pronunciation.
Maybe. I'd actually love to get a definitive answer on that, because when people correct you and they're not correct themselves, that's the sweetest dish.
Why don't you just Google search and play the audio there? We'll find out definitively.
Uh-huh. I can do that. I can do that. Conch pronunciation.
Conch.
I think that's pretty definitive.
Yeah, success.
I didn't know this, but if you put in pronunciation now into Google, it does it its own, and it says British pronunciation. I can choose American pronunciation. Uh-oh. Listen to this.
Conch.
No way. We are both correct. So in Florida, they say it wrong. You can actually, this is pretty good, isn't this? You can do it fast and slow.
Conch.
There you go. So in Google now, you can put in the word, it gives you the choice of dialect, and it actually has a little GIF showing you how your mouth should move to make the word conch.
Whoa, wait a minute. Did you say GIF? Did you mean GIF?
No, I didn't. It's GIF.
Do we need to check this as well?
You're joking though, right?
No, I'm genuinely not joking. No, I genuinely thought it was GIF.
No, it's a GIF.
Isn't GIF the floor cleaner?
It is, but it's also, and this is annoying, but it is actually GIF. It's a soft GIF. Look, I have a history in technology. I think I try, but also it just is. Do you want to hear someone pronounce GIF?
Sure, go for it. Why not?
GIF.
There you go.
He said GIF.
GIF.
He sounded like he said it twice, two different ways. It's just GIF. Anyway. We've whiled away 8 minutes. This is gold. This is, this is why people listen to the end. Our second text on conches is from Elizabeth. She says, I missed the name of the three musical notes instrument. Well, depending on where you live, Elizabeth, it's a conch or a conch. Tony D. Keane says, you didn't take turns holding the conch while speaking. I've read that book and it doesn't end well. What's that book?
Lord of the Flies. I read it very recently, Bing! Actually.
Correct. We were talking about solar thermal propulsion, which is, I learned something last week, which I didn't know, which is, of course, a turbine won't work in space. And I didn't think about that because there's no air for it to push off. I always thought, why don't you just stick a solar panel on the side of something and use that to propel the machine where it needs to go. But because the turbine's not hitting off air, that whole idea is out the window. You got to push against something, so you need some propulsion. And so solar thermal propulsion, if you were listening to last week's program, is the idea of using the heat of the sun to expand hydrogen gas that's in a chamber that makes when you essentially piss it out the back, you get much more bang for your buck because it's expanded because of the heat, and you don't need a lot of mass of hydrogen, so you get a lot more out of it. Anyway, Jonathan, easy to avoid the heat. We were talking about, how do you fly into the sun and not get burnt? And someone says, Jonathan, it's easy to avoid the heat of the sun during space travel. Just go at night. I've heard that joke before, but the first time I heard it, I was like, oh yeah, why don't you? Declan in Arklow says, that's Star Trek, The Journey Home. So this is already in Star Trek. It's been, it's canon. Is it, Deck? I haven't seen that one.
Well, it got in Star Trek, which is completely scientifically flawed. It takes them back in time doing this, if I remember correctly.
Using solar thermal propulsion.
Well, they fly towards the sun, and then I think they go around it or something. And for some reason, that sends you back in time.
Like in Superman 2.
Yes, like in Superman 2, exactly. Isn't that what happens? Yeah, so the Star Trek movies are not canon. They're not good. Okay.
The movies aren't canon. Is that up for debate?
Oh, I would say that.
The series only. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, series only. The movies are all Hollywooded up, and everyone's an action hero.
Well, I mean, what a thrilling end to this week's podcast that was. It had everything, didn't it? Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, the producer you just listened to. And thanks to the rest of the production team, Simon Keane, Steve Daunt, Garrett Mahal. Steve McLuhan was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Tuesday in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.